Welcome to Conversations on Coast Access Radio. In this program, we have conversations with people about their interests, their lives, the things that motivate and excite them. So relax and enjoy this conversation.
My guest today is a return guest, Tim Rogerson. Tim, welcome back to the studio.
Thank you, Graham.
We had a really fascinating conversation a few weeks back about your life and military history. And it was we only got part way through, so I invited you to come back and complete it. We left you sitting in Hong Kong.
Yes, one of the more sought-after postings, I think. And, of course, it was early 60s. And Hong Kong, well, we thought it was busy then, but it was nothing like the Hong Kong of today. I mean, it was a lovely posting. Militarily, we had to keep the Chinese from coming down into Hong Kong, mm-hmm. and that was our purpose. We did a lot of work with the police. We worked many exercises and we got to know them very well, and they were very good at their job too, the police in Hong Kong. Mm. They were mostly Brits who'd right. come out.
Mm. Was it quite a sizable army post?
It was quite sizable, yes. I mean, you had your gunners there, it was sort of brigade size.
Right. Right.
Three brigades is a division, you know that. So it was quite sizable.
Right, yeah. You had your family there with you at the same stage.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, I had a little daughter. I mean, we're talking early 60s. She was only just born, and we had an armour who looked after her.
Right. Yeah. Right. So then, from there on to Germany.
Yes, back to Germany. Went to Munster, which. Was very close to the Dutch border near Enschede,
mm-hmm.
And that was very pleasant to be able to drive across the border in about 40 minutes, I suppose, and you were in Holland. And the difference in lifestyle was quite incredible.
Oh, yes, indeed.
The Germans were very stur. They, wore these flower pot hats if they were women. And no smile on their face, and the colours they wore weren't bright. And you went across into Holland, and they were all on bicycles in shorts, and completely couldn't be more different between the two
right.
nations. It was a joy to go there. It really was. Mm.
Now, you mentioned a bit earlier when we were just talking about what we're going to talk about today, you actually resigned from the British Army in Germany. What brought that about?
Well, the year was 1966. There was a white paper out by the Labour government cutting back more of the army. It had been in 1956, it had been just about 800,000 troops, and with the Defence White Paper out, they were slashing it again in 1966, and they slashed it down to 412,000.
Right.
So it was, almost halved in those 10 years. And, of course, morale wasn't good. You don't want an army going, shrinking as rapidly as that. And so I made the decision to come out of the army. I had a New Zealand-born wife, and so it was fairly logical to make a clean break and to come over to New Zealand.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So I'm presuming you left other family back in the UK?
Yeah, my mother and father were both dead. I had an elder brother and a younger brother, but that was about it. Yeah.
But I guess, having lived the army life and been in a number of different continents and countries, coming to New Zealand wasn't that major a shift because you'd been...
No, I'd lived in many different countries. And I must say, it was one of the better decisions of my life. It was. I love New Zealand. I think it's just a superb place. People are very reasonable too. Don't have very many problems. Politics are a little bit sort of mixed and mysterious, but otherwise it's just a lovely country to be in.
Right.
I've done all the major tracks in New Zealand, walked all the major tracks.
Right, right.
And I accept the Milford's the only one I haven't done.
And you don't have any hopes to do that?
I think I'm getting a bit slower and... If I start something, I'm going to finish it, and I don't want a failure amongst the tracks.
Which of the tracks stands out for you as your favourite? Is there one you look back on?
Ooh.
Or is that like asking how long's the piece of string?
The Root Burn, followed by the Greenstone. I've circumnavigated Ruapehu, which was very interesting. You'd think that you'd be on the level going round Ruapehu, but you're certainly not. You're up and down all the time.
Oh, indeed, yes.
That was interesting. And it's just beautiful. It's just beautiful.
Mm. So you arrive in New Zealand? Do you come to a military job? What do you do?
No. Well, we came out by Rangitane, the New Zealand Shipping Company line. I paid the fare. We got here for £200, the whole family, which sounds, in today's terms, very, very reasonable. But, of course, a penny, as I said before, a penny bought a pint almost in those days.
Yes.
Things were much cheaper. And when I got here, I realised that they had a territorial force, so I thought, well, I've something I can do back again. Mm. So I joined the territorials. But I did a miscellany of incredible jobs.
Right.
The first job I did, it was unbelievable. Do you remember the guy who started the Albany sort of love-in place?
Potter?
Potter.
Bert Potter. Yes.
Well, he had a thing called pest-free services. So I joined that and crawled under all of the wooden houses looking for Ambiodontus tristis, which was two-tooth longhorn eating the base of the house. You know, the wooden flooring. I mean, all the houses were wooden then. And, you'd mark them and then you'd sell the treatment of getting rid of them. And that's how I made my commissions, crawling under houses, you know, past dried up dead rats and cats.
That's
and
right.
Tins and bottles. And that's how I started.
Oh, I understand that so well. Part of my working career was a technician installing cabling for various projects.
Oh, God, it would be the same, wouldn't it?
It's amazing what you discover under old buildings.
Yes, I know.
At least there's no snakes and deadly spiders.
No, that's true.
But until you've crawled through a thick webbing of cobweb, you really don't know what life is.
No, you don't.
So where to after that?
Well, I bought 11 acres with a friend of mine called Jack Lawson, a Scotsman, a lovely fellow. He's still alive. And we turned the 11 acres into Rockwell Gardens. We grew all sorts of hedging plants, mainly a thing called Phabalium, which is resistant to salt winds. And the farmers... coastal farmers bought it. We grew tens of thousands of those, hundreds of thousands of those, and sent them to palmers and people like that.
Right.
And then we had to keep the cash flowing in, so we did cash crops, and we grew farden loads of beans. We grew carrots, lots of them, sweet corn at Christmas time, and that's how we sort of existed.
And is this in the Auckland region?
No, this was outside of Whangarei.
Oh, okay, right, yes.
Yeah, up there, yeah. Nice part of New Zealand.
Very nice part of New Zealand. Yeah. In fact, I don't think there were any unnice parts of New Zealand.
No, but the beaches up there are just stunning.
Indeed.
They really are.
He's had an uncle living at Ruakaka.
Right. That's nice too.
Just beautiful beaches.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Apart from the day we lost the boat, coming home, we arrived at the farmhouse to look back at the trailer to realise that the boat was no longer there.
Oh.
It had popped off on one of the humpback bridges, but that's another story.
Got
it. So what was it like working as in the territorials? You've come from a professional British military background. Mm-hmm. What did our territorials look like in comparison?
Well, the territorials, of course, numerically were superior to the regulars, and they wouldn't have had an army at all if we hadn't had the territorials. I don't remember the numbers, but I mean, all up, it was something about 3,500, 4,000, and the majority were territorials. Very professional, very good soldiers. I mean, history will tell you, you know, how good the New Zealanders were. And Montgomery always, if he had a difficult task, he used the New Zealanders, because he said they're quite amazing at night. You know, they know exactly where they are. They can read the stars and they don't get lost. He said, you know, some of my lot, he said, are hopeless. And
right, because they're city boys.
Yeah, all city boys.
And that's not demeaning them either.
No. No one wants to be a soldier.
Exactly. So did you stay in the territorials, or did you move into regular forces?
I stayed for quite a while. I did about 18 years, I think, as a territorial soldier. Yeah. I ended up as a deputy commander of one brigade. And then I had this lovely tour. I was asked if I wanted to go to the Middle East with the United Nations. And I jumped at that. I was at the time a half colonel, serving as a half colonel, and there was only a major's spot, so I didn't give that a moment's thought. I went down to major and went out and filled a slot and caught up the Yom Kippur War, which was the most fascinating war.
Indeed.
It really was. And it was very brutal. It was very short, and one of the biggest tank battles ever. Huge air battles. And I got right in the middle of that, doing observation work, first of all, on the Golan Heights, and then going back into headquarters and being deeply involved as an operations officer. The chief of staff came to me because it was so close to World War III. The Russians had 15 divisions south of the Black Sea, and the Americans had the eighth fleet in the Mediterranean waters, and everyone was very jittery. The Russians in particular, they asked if they could put a military presence into the United Nations Truth Supervision Organization, which had 16 different nations, you know, doing the looking and stopping over flights and incursions over the demilitarized zone. And the chief of staff came to me and said, look, I'm going to talk to the Russians in Cairo. I'd like you to come with me. So the only way we could get there, because there was no flying at the time, it was just on the end of the war. And we drove across the Sinai Desert, which was cluttered with destroyed tanks, artillery, small vehicles, quarter-tonners, three-tonners, bodies hanging out of them which were charred. They were just black and charred because the Israelis out of the Phantoms had dropped napalm on the tanks, on the Israeli and Egyptian tanks, and just cooked it, cooked the whole tank. And all the ammunition exploded inside the tank. Dreadful way to go. And so we just went past all these spots. The whole thing was closed. They wouldn't allow anybody on it. And we had to drive down, of course, had clearance, because we were going to talk to the Russians to bring them in. And we went to Cairo, the chief of staff and myself. I drove. And, you know, you had a sort of prickly feeling in your back because, you know, had all these mines that were laid, minefields that weren't properly mapped, barbed wire and all sorts of things. And anyway, we got there and we talked to a Colonel Bellick and a Captain Kussmein. Captain Kussmein would be KGB watching Bellick. And we thrashed out all of the things that had to happen. And 2 weeks later, they were on the ground operating in UNTSO, United Nations Troop Supervision Organization, and did a very good job too. They were very amusing. I mean, they couldn't drive to save themselves. They had to bring their own quarter-ton vehicles, and the accident rate went up like climbing Everest. And the other thing they loved, of course, was they wanted lots of American films to see.
Right.
And they wanted us to help them bring their families out, and most of us didn't have our families there. New Zealand didn't have families there unless they paid for them to go out, which I did. And it was great education for the two girls we had. Because when we weren't on ops, we could get a quarter tonner, paid a small amount of money per kilometre, and you'd go off and look at things like Petra and Crack de Chevalier, all these beautiful things that are out in the Middle East.
Yes.
And because it was Yom Kippur, there were no foreigners, tourists there at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you went to these places, they were empty and you had them all to yourselves. Petra was just stunning.
Yes, Petra's always been on my to-do list.
Yeah.
This is never going to happen. But the documentaries I've watched, it's just a stunning place, isn't it?
Yeah, you come through this fissure in the rocks, about 160 feet high and not very wide. You can just get a quarter tonner down them. And it goes on for about a kilometre. And you can just see the sky, you know, up as a crack above as you go through. A lot of people ride horses through.
Mm.
And when you come out, to the most beautiful building with all these pillars carved in this very soft, beautiful coloured rock.
Mm.
It's like a Neapolitan ice cream, all the colours.
Right.
And you come out to the Treasury building, and it's just gorgeous. And that's what hits you as you come out of this narrow fissure. This beautifully carved building. And then you go around, and then, of course, all the houses are carved into the rock. Because it's so very dry, there is very little erosion. And everything has stayed almost exactly as it was.
What a fascinating and dreadful at the same time contrast. You've driven through a battlefield with all the horrors that you can imagine. And then you're standing in a place of incredible beauty and history.
I know.
Aren't us humans fascinating creatures?
We are funny, aren't we?
Yeah. But it must have been a really interesting experience working alongside the Russian folk. Here we are, as you say, on the verge of World War III and all those tensions, and yet the willingness of the Russians to also participate to actually keep things
under control. Well, they wanted to keep the peace. I mean, that's really what it was.
Mm.
They didn't want an escalation. No. And their troops, they obviously picked some of the best. And one of the questions they asked us when we got down there, the chief of staff and myself, how many people are there in the mission altogether? How many? There were 16 different nationals. Who has the most? And there was no rhyme or reason for the numbers, but the Swedes had 36. They had the most. How many of the Americans got, they asked very quickly. We said 8. And they laughed and they said, can we have 36? And we said, yes, you know, backwards and forwards and everything. And so the Americans, 2 weeks later, had got an extra 28 out there to make 36.
Isn't that delightful?
Yeah.
Do you look back on that period with a measure of pride that you were actually involved in a vital part
I think
of
I was extraordinarily lucky.
Yeah.
To be involved. Extraordinarily lucky.
Mm.
It was historic, everything at that time there. You know, the verge of World War III, the building up of the Russians coming in, and it was really historic.
Mm. You've written down your recollections and has it been well documented by others?
Two thirds of the way through, and I've got writer's cramp.
Now, I'm going to swap directions on you absolutely and completely. You brought on the book Ascent of Everest, and you've got an autographed version by Ed Hillary. Tell us about how that comes about.
I carry this around with me because it was the prize for PT at Sandhurst, and I'm very thrilled to get it. And I was determined, when I came to New Zealand, to get Ed Hillary's signature in it. And I'd already got John Hunt's signature mm-hmm. because I was at Sandhurst when I received this prize. And John Hunt was a lecturer at the Staff College, which shares the same ground in Camberley in Surrey in England.
Right.
And so I went and knocked on his door, and he opened it and said, yes. And I said, do you think you'd be kind enough to sign my copy of The Ascent of Everest, which is leather-bound and in gold leaf? And he said, I'd be delighted. And he signed it. And he said, congratulations on winning this prize, Sir John Hunt, and the date, which was December 55. And then I was determined from 1955 on to get the second signature, for the book. And it took until 91, and I phoned up Lady Hillary, and she said, he's just flying in from Nepal. And he'll be here tomorrow morning. And if you are here at 9 o'clock, I will have him here to sign your book. And I said, well, that's very kind of you. I get there at 9 o'clock, and there's a very grumpy Ed Hillary saying, you know, what have I got to sign bloody book at this time of day for? And I said, probably because your wife told you to.
Yes, so true.
But he was charming. And we're standing on the steps of his garden, and he's so tall. I made sure I was one step higher than him
right. When
we looked at this book together for the photograph, which is it's quite historic.
Right.
I'm very proud of that.
And that really is family treasure, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, no one else in the world probably has got those two signatures in a leather-bound and a gold-leaf book.
It'll eventually end up in the Turnbull Library, perhaps?
I don't know. I'll leave it to one other family, I think.
Indeed. Tim, we've wandered all over the place. We've got a few moments left. What's it like now moving into retirement, later years of life, reflecting back on your life journey?
Well, retirement are the happiest chapters of my life. It's the first time completely without any responsibility. There are lots of lovely things to do. I'm reading books that I read ages back and enjoyed. I've got a library of books at home, and I sort of look through them. The Wicked Wit of Winston Churchill I've just reread. I'm looking at Letter from America by Alastair Cook at the moment. I'm reading that. You know, all these things. And I think they're the happiest chapters of my life.
Right.
And it's lovely. I've got the most adorable wife who really spoils me rotten. And it's a lovely existence. We've got a lovely house which we thoroughly enjoy.
Mm. And living in an area with stunning beauty and birds and wildlife.
Yeah, we've got a lovely view of Kapiti Island.
Isn't that just magic?
Extraordinary. Yeah.
I've lived down at the Waikanae estuary for years, no longer there at the moment, but just walking around the river estuary is just good for the soul.
Yeah, of
course. The sea, the birds, it's just a wonderful place to be.
And this has been the most extraordinary winter, if you can call it that. I mean, you know, autumn. We've had summer, an extended summer, and even out there now it's beautifully warm.
Indeed it is. Indeed.
I think we're very lucky.
Mm. Yeah. Well, Tim, thank you for coming in and sharing a couple of programs on your history, your reflections. It's been really interesting. Thank you.
I've had a lucky life.
You've been listening to Conversations on Coast Access Radio, a program where we talk with people about their lives, their passions, their interests. I'm Graham Joyce.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.